Their goal isn't punishment, it's power, it's acquisition.
Carlisle might not ask you to fight, but I will. For the sake of my family, but also for yours. And for the way you want to live.
The Pax will fight. We've never been afraid of vampires.
We will fight.
This won't be the first time I've fought a king's rule.
We'll join you.
We will stand with you.
So will we.
That didn't take much.
Let's hope it doesn't come to that.
We'll see.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me, as always, are associate editors Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And Dave Trumbore.
Hello.
Today we will be talking about Twilight. Hopefully for the final time about Twilight. And it has come to a close. We'll be talking about the Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn, Part 2, and more importantly, the legacy of the Twilight franchise, along with the importance of an intended audience, because I think that is a very important topic relating to the quality of the Twilight franchise. And as always, we will finish up with our recommendations. So let's get right to it. Twilight has had a remarkable impact in a way that not all successful franchises do. Superhero movies, yes. But let's look back to 2001, and Lord of the Rings is a huge success. And then you get all these fantasy imitators. And
the Golden Compass.
The Golden Compass. Aragorn. His Dark Material. Or his Dark Materials is Golden Compass. What is it?
Yeah.
The Seeker. The Dark is Rising. Was that one? Is
yeah,
that
that's the
title? Yeah. Yeah, there you go. We got a lot of them, and none of them took off. And with Twilight, it's hard to say if anything has taken off, although I think we're still waiting for those movies, aren't we? That the deluge will come very soon when we see The Host and Beautiful Creatures, and I can't really call The Hunger Games an heir to Twilight. I mean, yeah, there's a female protagonist, and yes, there is the semblance of a love triangle, but really its only major shared impact is that they're both young adult fiction, and they're based, you know, they're novels, and I think that's about it, right? Do you guys see any...
Yeah.
Major...
Yeah, there's not a supernatural, really, tie-in there. There's not a, you know, Hunger Games is more dystopian kind of adventure. But yeah, I mean, they've got the love interest and the female protagonist and the book series. That's about it.
Right.
And a rabid fan base, too, but
well,
it's not...
What's interesting about the Hunger Games, though, is that when it came out, it was... Before it came out, everyone's like, oh, here's another, like, Twilight ripoff. Everyone was anticipating that it would be a Twilight ripoff.
Unless they had read the book.
Yeah, and what actually happened is that is off its own successors. You've got Divergent. I mean, you've got a bunch of these kind of Hunger Games-esque. You know, the CW went for a pilot for something called, like, The Selection, I think, which was essentially the same plot. And now they're working on a Battle Royale TV series, which is, I mean, there's some debate in the literary world whether Suzanne Collins ripped off Battle Royale for The Hunger Games. But, but yeah, I think everyone expected it to be a Twilight ripoff, but what happened is that The Hunger Games has spawned its own ripoffs now. Or I mean, I don't mean to use ripoff as...
Let's say hopeful successors.
Hopeful successors.
Let's use the most positive terms we can. I also forgot to mention The Mortal Instruments, which I see
as
a successor to Twilight.
And I get that one and Beautiful Creatures confused when we're doing write-ups and stuff on them all the time.
There you go. And, I mean, there are others that haven't really taken off. Like, I think The Maze Runner might be in there, or maybe not.
Yeah,
maybe
and that's been out for a while.
That's
as far
been
as
Hunger
the book
Games.
Is,
yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Young adult fiction will remain a boom no matter what, because that's the perfect audience for a PG-13 film, and there is a lot of potential there. For a relatively low cost, none of these movies really are huge expenses. Even Hunger Games only cost $80 million, and I know, like, only $80 million, but relative to what superhero movies cost, $80 million for what they got back on their investment is huge.
Right, that's like the modern day equivalent of like a mid-budget movie, like we used to see the $30-40 million range for different action movies and things like that. that 70 to 80 range now seems sort of like that's the new center that people are trying to hit for movies like this.
Right. So with Twilight, though, it has left an impact. And I'm curious to know what kind of impact that is. I haven't read a lot of young adult fiction. And I guess distilling it down to its basic elements, what is Twilight? And I know that may seem like an obvious question, but if you were to break down its elements to the reason it's most successful, what would you say?
Sex.
No, I'm serious. Because
it's a young adult relationship. I mean, from my understanding, I've seen the first movie, I've read the first book. That's about as far as I can get. But to my understanding, it's basically just the relationships of teenagers. And it just happens to have a supernatural kind of hint to it, too. See, that's kind of at the core, I think.
I see it as something on three levels for three different audiences. For preteens, adolescents, girls in their from about 12 to, let's say, 40. 12 to 16. Maybe 12 to 15, doesn't matter. The Twilight books are informative. That is to say, it is almost instructional in terms of how it says this is how girls are supposed to relate to boys. And that's where I find the series at its most insidious. The next group is the, let's say, 21 to 30 group. The women who say, yeah, this is trashy, but you know, it's fun trash. I enjoy it. I understand. I'm not taking moral lessons from it, but it is lets me indulge in a fantasy that's just fun. For them, it's a fun book. And then you
it's taking the place of the trashy sort of like grocery store.
Yeah, exactly. Precisely.
Yeah.
And then there's the over 40 sad Haagen-Dazs women. And I know that sounds like really misogynistic, but I will never forget when I was at my first Comic-Con, and that's where Twilight made its debut. I mean, Twilight has been, except for Eclipse, which was just a release date thing, they've all been at Comic-Con in Hall H. And I will never forget, this woman comes to the mic, she's over 40, and she asks, she's like, for the male members on stage, boxers, briefs, or nothing at all. And Woo! That's when I vomited in my mouth a little bit.
Yeah.
And just when, like, first off, classy. Second, that's the thing. Like, it's taken it too far from the, oh, this is fun trash, to an element of desperation, a wish fulfillment for something lost. So you have these three sections, and I think it's interesting how three different groups can find appeal in the same story.
Right.
And also that this same story seems to work to the exclusion of everybody else.
Absolutely.
Seriously.
No, I agree. I represent that everybody else, I think.
And again, and just to be clear, this isn't like all 12 to 15 girls. I'm not saying like if you're in that group, how can you not like Twilight? I'm just saying that it seems to be its fan base is in those three groups.
Yeah, those are the people that are coming out and you know, giving them the $140 million opening weekend. They just happen to be in that range.
I think it also works as, I think it's kind of, to dumb it down into those three categories. I think there's also other people that it's a fantasy for women, not in the sense of like a sexual fantasy, but, you know, for people who aren't into Lord of the Rings, this is something that is interesting to them. This relationship, these people,
people
in the town, it's a fantasy in the way that like you wouldn't, like fans of like Lord of the Rings, you wouldn't really, you know, kind of break that down into three categories and say like that. I would say that it's kind of more, I don't know, just I think it appeals to them on a level that is just it's entertaining and it's fun and it's fantasy.
Yeah. Well, I think it's wish fulfillment and it's not just a sexual nature. It's Bella is everyone loves this really boring girl and it's everyone she in Breaking Dawn Part 1. They are sent on a dream vacation. In part two, they get a house. They don't really have to work for anything.
It's like the game of life. It's fantastic.
It is. That coming soon to a theater near you.
Oh, don't. I mean,
way to go, Tremore. You ruined it. That'll be your next. That'll be your next. That'll be your next. Adapt this.
It sure will be.
The game of life.
The game of life. No, it's wish fulfillment, and so it's those different elements. I mean, that goes back a ways. I mean, Barbie is wish fulfillment.
Right, exactly. And exactly. So, that's exactly what I was thinking of when you were saying, like, it's sort of an instruction manual on how to live your life as a teenage girl. That's the first thing that I thought of. It was almost like going back and looking to Barbie dolls as they came out as sort of this, like, ideal symbol of what you're supposed to kind of aspire to, you know, the house, the Corvette, the Ken doll, all that kind of stuff. It's just a more modern version of the same thing.
And that's where I get uncomfortable with Twilight. I used to really hate Twilight, and I don't hate it as much anymore because I understand those other two groups, even the over 40s, you know, I mean, right. It makes me a little sad, but I mean, they're adults, and if it gives them joy, so be it. And they found something to like, that's great. But there's a younger readership that I am concerned for. And maybe that's a little paternalistic of me, maybe. I don't know. But
I think it's accurate, though.
You think it's fair? You think it's a fair...
I think it's
Stephanie
fair
Meyer's subtext is terrible.
It really is. And that's where I can't be like, oh, it's frivolous. Because I think it is doing harm.
Yeah, like what percentage of those young readers are going to keep this as their foundation, and which ones are going to, you know, get to college and take some, I don't know, women's lib classes or whatever, just get into the college experience where you're presented with a lot of different takes on life and relationships and opportunities. You know, what percentage is going to stick with the Twilight route, and what percentage is going to kind of come into the real world and see that things aren't necessarily the way they're portrayed in the books and the movies.
Also worth noting, Bella never goes to college. She decides to get married out of high school. Just a little...
See, just throw that in there, yeah.
That's the thing. Bella, if you have these two groups, and my understanding from the books, and I can kind of see it in the movies, and Dave, you've read the first book.
Just
Bella
the first
is kind of a blank slate that the reader can project herself onto. And so for the women, I'm going to refer to them as girls and women. For the women, they're like, oh, I can just use Bella as my vehicle. I will be Bella. I can, because she'll fit. You know, she can be what I want her to be because she's such a blank slate. But for the girls, she is a role model, an unintended role model. But because they put themselves in Bella's shoes in a way that, oh, this is how women are supposed to act, rather than understanding the fantasy element of it.
I mean, I'm hoping there's still a contingent out there that is intelligent enough to and mature enough. I know we're talking about, you know, 12 to 15-year-old girls, but I'm hoping there's a decent-sized contingent out there that is just reading it for entertainment value.
Well, and maybe they'll pick up the Hunger Games and be like, no, I don't have to choose between men. I can just murder things.
I just
want to become murderous.
Yeah, well, exactly.
I will take up archery and become aloof.
Until it gets to Mockingjay.
Oh, God, Mockingjay.
And it undoes some of that.
It's like, now I'll just become a miserable human being as life goes on and bad things happen. Just crawl into a hole. Anyway, but we're getting ahead of ourselves on that one. So Twilight has this issue, and it's this double-edged sword. And I think when the movies came about, I don't know, have viewers ever really accepted Kristen Stewart as Bella? Have they ever been like, yay, Kristen Stewart? Because I think, and again, this is going back to my first Comic-Con, first Twilight panel, and so purely anecdotal, but I was talking to people, it's like, she's not Bella, and it's like, I think Bella's blonde in the books, like, as if that's her defining, I mean, really, it's that thin of a character.
Right.
But really, it's, to me, I've always felt that people who couldn't accept Kristen Stewart is because Kristen Stewart there gives definition to the role, and not in the it's an amazing performance in the sense that they can no longer imagine themselves as Bella. Bella now looks and acts like Kristen Stewart. So
see,
I think
from
that
my experience, the people that I know that have read the book and they fall into that second group that you talked about, the 21 to 34 who know it's terrible but read it because it's fun. Basically have said that just Kristen Stewart is terrible in the role. And having seen the movies, I can say that I think Kristen Stewart can be a good actress. I don't think she's good in these movies.
Could anyone be good in that role, though?
I don't know, but she's just – I think – I don't know. It's so tough because you can tell. Well, it's so obvious that her and Robert Pattinson are so out of. They just know that they're above all of this.
As I think well Kristen they Stewart should.
Buys into it a little bit more. But I think, I mean, I know Robert Pattinson's way over it. I think Kristen Stewart buys into it a little bit more, but she's just not particularly great in this, though nor was she in Snow White and the Huntsman.
Well, I also
I think it goes back to what you were saying about how that character is written, and maybe that goes to the you know, the screenwriter and whoever was adapting
Melissa
these.
Melissa Rosenberg.
Yeah, that rather than actually adapt them and give her some character taken in whatever direction you want to. It's more of just a translation. So, like you were saying, that Bella's character is just supposed to be this blank slate that is very reactive to everything that's going on around her. And you're supposed to just kind of, you know, she's a placeholder. You put yourself in her shoes. So how is an actor supposed to take that and do anything with it if it's not, you know, if it's not out there on the page for her? She can't be really this independent and making her own choices if everything is kind of laid out and decided for her. So that's a tough spot for any actor, I think.
Absolutely, and I think that it's come down to the directors mm-hmm. to really bring out any life in these actors, and I think Bill Condon was the only one to really do it. I think mm-hmm. the others were just like, we got to stay faithful. We got to do what we're here to do. We're getting our paycheck, and our job is to stay, is to make the fans happy.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Condon, I think, said, well, what can we make them happy? We're going to have our plot points. So can't we just make them happy by maybe making these characters happier? Can't we give our actors a little more room to maybe, if they're this unhappy, be in on the joke for once and seem to have a good time? Because I think that's what's been missing. I mean, these films have been very mopey up until the end, really, up until Breaking Dawn. And even Breaking Dawn isn't like fun for all, but it's still it's so much more joyful than the first three films. So I would say that it's partially a poorly written role, and it's partially directors who didn't probably feel that their job was to challenge their actors. Basically everyone seems to be playing by the book, and that can't be much fun to translate. I mean, isn't that stifling to
Do you guys think that this last installment is the best one of the series? That's kind of what
I think
I've
it's
heard.
I think it's the most entertaining for okay. someone, and only because of what happens towards the end. But I still think that David Slade made a pretty entertaining movie with Eclipse. They're from an outsider perspective, they're not good movies. And I think the main issue boils down to the source material and the fact that they're so beholden to the source material, and they're not especially cinematic stories, and they're chained down to these plot points and character points that they have to get through. Like the imprinting storyline pops up in Eclipse, but David Slade didn't want to touch it. Like all these directors, they knew that it came up, and they knew that it gets hinted at before in the earlier books so that it's more palatable at the end, but they knew it was ridiculous, so they didn't touch it. They just passed it on. They said, let someone else deal with that when it gets to Breaking Dawn.
And yet no one said, let's just drop it entirely.
Exactly, and that's the issue that Dave brought up, is that this fidelity to the source material, and I think that's one of the reasons that these movies have been successes, but they have not been crossover hits. They've made essentially the same amount of money for each movie. There's not a giant fluctuation between the two. They haven't even made more for each subsequent installment. Breaking Dawn Part 1 had $281 million, and Eclipse had $300. And I think that's because they don't have crossover appeal. If you haven't read the books, you're not just like an unabashed fan of the other movies. You're not going to buy into this. You're not going to suddenly become a fan.
Yeah, it's the same people going to see each installment as it comes out. It's the same audience. You're getting these same people to buy the same tickets each time. That's basically it. Now, it's interesting going back to your earlier points, though, about these other movies that kind of came out. Now we're going to get into the second wave of them with, Beautiful Creatures, Mortal Instruments, things like that. I think what was missing in some of the other earlier installments was kind of that fan base, though. I don't think, you know, Aragon didn't have that.
It
has readers, but it doesn't have a rabid fan base, right?
It doesn't have a rabid fan base, and it didn't really build energy. I mean, Twilight was also very well marketed. It made itself
Absolutely.
Very important every step of the way, just like Hunger Games did. And also, to be fair, Aragon came about in a different age. We're now as movie blogs, we play into the casting sweepstakes, which is marketing from the get-go. Who will it be? And so already it's a horse race. It's something to keep an eye on. And so already we're like, who will play what?
As I just had a flash matters. To the Star Wars stories we're going to have to run. And
God.
I mean, it's bad enough with the director right now. At least you got the writer's
God. We will talk Star Wars, and I think we're going to do it very soon, people. So if you want to hear us talk Star Wars with our first guest that we've ever had on the show, you may want to come back next week.
It'll be the director of Star Wars Episode 7.
Yes. Director Brett Ratner will be on the collision, and then everyone killed themselves. They're like, bring back George! Bring back George! We don't care! Do it! Do it! We don't care! We're sorry! But I was going, what were we talking about? Oh, right, Twilight. That goes to my point. It's like, our fan base is better than your fan base. I mean, Star Wars fans are absolutely nuts, and they've had 35 years to go insane. Whereas right. Twilight is really 5 years and done. And we're done here. I mean, yeah, the series will probably get rebooted at some point, but for right now, we're done. We're done here. Star Wars is back, and it's a big way, and it's going to be scrutinized and analyzed every little word. I almost want to come out and say, I'm directing Episode 7, just so we'll be done. Just to say, look, it's done. I know it's not true, but we're done. We can move on. And I'll star in it, and I'll edit it, and I'll cater it, just so we'll be done with Star Wars. And yet there will be people, I mean, our site will get so many hits, because that's what the people want. And I mean, is it important just to give the people what they want? Isn't that it? And I mean, that's Twilight. They gave the people what they want.
They gave the people what they want because they want what the people have, which is their money. And I mean, it's just, it's been great for Summit. And that's really all it is. I mean, with Star Wars, it's something that it was a filmmaker's original idea to start with and a film that started it all. So they have complete freedom, well, for the most part. I mean, Lucas still has all those original ideas, but they have complete freedom to go wherever they want in the world with these characters. Twilight, like we just, you know, spent a few minutes talking about, you're tied to those books. So unless there are new books that come out, you're forced to either reboot the series and reboot those existing books and just kind of keep doing that throughout perpetuity. Or Meyer is just going to have to come out with prequels or...
And she totally will. She totally will.
She,
I mean,
probably,
I think
she
that...
Have to, but she probably
she doesn't will. Have to, but I can easily see her doing that and then Summit, I guess, paying through the nose to get all the actors back, assuming the characters return, or maybe they can just CGI Mackenzie Foy's face onto everything.
Oh, God. That was the worst thing.
CGI baby! I mean... Terrible. Bill Condon is not a bad director, but I don't know where that decision came from and why it was there. And as if it's one of those things where, as an audience, we've just learned how and where to suspend our disbelief. We know it's like, oh, it's okay if that baby doesn't look like the 7-year. Babies tend not to look like anyone. Babies are fairly nondescript. I hate to say it, but what you look like as a baby doesn't even come close to what you look like now. Not at all. And so the notion that they're like, the audience won't buy this baby if we don't CG it up. And also, babies are readily available from horrible parents who are just like, take my baby, use it in shots, or you can use a puppet. It's not like animals. Animals I get starting, animals are largely now just all CGI because it's just easier. You don't have to worry about the PETA people or the AFPCA. Trainers. It's just easier, and we have the technology to do convincing animals. Fine.
For those of you who didn't see Breaking Dawn Part 2 and are confused, they Benjamin Buttoned, the actress who plays Renesmee, and made her face on a baby. So there's a CGI baby in the movie.
Yikes.
Yeah. And that did not pan out. You know
was
what?
It
let's talk
than
about
the one from Ally McBeal. At least
have we gotten past that? Have we gotten?
Is our technology on baby?
If they had made baby Mackenzie Foy dance, that would have been better. let's talk about Breaking Dawn Part 2 specifically, because I think it encapsulates what has always been wrong with this franchise and why it has not been inviting to others. Adam, would you like to do a plot synopsis?
I haven't seen part one, so...
Okay, I'll see. I've seen them all. I've seen them all!
I've seen them all but part one, so I'm a lesser man.
Okay, part one basically ends with Bella gives birth to Renesmee, who is Etern, Jacob's daughter, and which shouldn't be, vampires shouldn't be able to reproduce.
Hold up. Her and whose daughter?
Edward?
I heard Jacob, so I'm just wanted to clarify.
Oh, I'm sorry, Edward.
Or myself. And...
No, Jacob's a douchebag, and no one wants to fuck him.
Got it.
So,
except all the 40-year-old moms out
there. All
the
40. She's like, I'll be, or whatever. I don't
even
know.
The baby.
You can imprint all over my face.
Oh, dear.
I took it there. So, she has the baby. Jacob imprints on the baby, which basically means it's... Crassly, it's like he falls in love with the baby, but then... to put it in terms that the movie wants to put it in, he is now her protector. That is his job in life, and now he has realized that.
Couldn't he just be like a godparent? Well, whatever. Go ahead.
Whatever. No, it's a dumb idea, and it just should have been cut, because the same idea could have been done without this mystical imprinting whatever. Because
right.
It's just too vague and opens itself up to these weird things. So anyway, she has the baby. In order to survive, Bella is turned into a vampire, and it ends like Avatar, where the eyes open. That's how Breaking Dawn Part 1 ends. So Breaking Dawn Part 2 ends, and it actually starts off pretty fun. Bella is a newborn vampire, so she kind of has to get her bloodlust under control, but she really enjoys it. She can run fast, she can leap, she just feels really good about it. And then she's like, I'm proud to be a mother. And so it's going through these motions, and Twilight is a lot of wheel spinning, of mm-hmm. just working out logistics and stuff, but it looks like things are going to be okay. But then there's just basically a huge misunderstanding where Maggie Grace, who's a vampire from a neighboring clan, she spots Renesmee, who's growing much faster than she should. She looks like she's 7, even though I guess she's like, 6 months old? And still doesn't have, and she apparently also has the intelligence of a 7-year-old. She's not like it's never implied that she's like, still has the mental intelligence of a 6-month-old. She's just, now she's 7. Good to go. So anyway, she sees her, and apparently there's the thought that she's a quote-unquote newborn immortal child, which I guess my understanding was it's like a vampire kid. Adam, is that like...
It's turning a child, like taking
right.
a 6-year-old.
Okay,
turning
it's turning
a child.
Like and
Interview
just,
with a Vampire.
Yeah, and they're just too reckless, so the Volturi have to come in and kill them. So Maggie Grace thinks she's seen an immortal child. She goes to the Volturi, led by Aro, played by the great Michael Sheen, and they're like, yes, we're going to go kill that child. But their ulterior motive is to get... they have an ulterior motive. And so the Cullens are like, we don't want to fight. What we're going to do is travel around the world, get other vampire clans to see that Renesmee is awesome and totally not an immortal child, and they'll be our witnesses. And then we'll just convince the Volturi that she's not an immortal child, and we'll then all go out for pancakes. that really is the pancake thing I made up, but it would...
Ah, damn it.
I would so... That'd be better.
I thought Denny's or IHOP would get on here. And
oh, absolutely. Got to get some product placement. So that's the big conflict. But like the other films, it's very slow moving, although it plays a lot more like kind of like X-Men The Last Stand, mm-hmm. where... Because I forgot that vampires have superpowers. Like, I thought like a few of them did, but they all have superpowers.
I saw the featurette for this where it's like they introduce all the clans from around the world, and they're like, each one of these individual vampires has a superpower. And I'm just like, what the hell is going on?
Yeah, so like Rami Malek can like control the elements, and... Although not all of them can. Like, Lee Pace doesn't seem to be able to do anything. He's just like,
charming as hell.
He's just like, I'm the... he's an American vampire, but he's a British actor, but he's playing an American vampire. And Joe Anderson just comes up to, like, tell people, like, this is going to fail. I just showed up to let y'all know this is going to go
He's the dark
horrible.
Cloud.
He is. He's just
Lee
Johnny
Pace
Rain Cloud.
Lee Pace is American.
Lee Pace is American?
Yeah, he was born in Oklahoma.
Oh, God. Well, of course you would know Oklahoma. Okay, so, but don't they find him in London or something? Maybe that's why I was confused. They find him not in America,
I think.
Anyway, doesn't matter. So, not everyone has, but like some can, like one vampire can control electricity, but all the Volturi have their own special powers, like Dakota Fanning can make people feel pain, like we saw in New Moon. And there's one that can, like, shoot, like, mists out of, like, dark mist out of his fingertips. And
spooky ghost stuff.
Spooky ghost stuff. Like, they all have special powers, and they're all lining up for a big battle.
This sounds amazing, by the
Dude,
way. I want this to keep going.
No, and then it gets amazing.
Yes.
It gets amazing. All right, people, if you don't want to know what happens in Breaking Dawn Part 2, stop listening now, because we got to discuss this. Because it really does encapsulate why the films have never connected. So stop listening now. Thanks for listening. Come back next week. Or just kind of skip to the end. I don't know what to tell you.
This I suggest just... you listen to this and then go step into the last 45 minutes of the movie at some theater just to watch it.
Exactly.
Just so, slide in.
Basically, there is an amazing battle scene. And
are you saying this ironically? I'm not sure.
No.
It's legitimately
amazing. Cool. Now, I forgot going into it that the only way to kill a vampire is to pop its head off. And so there are decapitations galore as the Cullens and all their like vampire clan friends go up against the Volturi. So it's a huge superhero battle. The Cullens have werewolves on their side, so the werewolves are fighting, and like a pit of fire opens up from the elements guy who's just like, yeah, and like people are falling into the fire pit, and they rip this one dude's heads open from like putting like their hands. Oh my god, it's just awesome. And people die. That's the thing. Because this is not how it goes down in the book. In the book, like, they really do like meet up, oh, this is a misunderstanding, and then go their separate ways.
For pancakes.
Who cares? Like, Stephanie Meyer's like, yeah, that seems like a good resolution. I don't understand what climax is.
All the other pages gathering all these vampires and everything, that's the way the book ends.
Oh my god.
That's what I've never heard the book ending, I just heard it was terrible.
Yeah, that's the least popular of the book.
Watching them gather the vampires and get ready for the big fight and come together, and they just shake hands and say, all right, see ya.
That's a problem I have with the host, too, is like she doesn't know how to understand action. But anyway.
Yeah, so there's this huge battle, and the audience I saw it with, they were not expecting it. So, like, Carlyle dies. He gets his head popped up, and they're like, oh my god! What the hell? And then deaths go all around, and they are into it. They are cheering, they are shocked, and this isn't in the book, right? Oh my god, we're not being faithful right now. So none of it's in the book, and this amazing battle, and I'm invested. I am invested in Twilight. I don't know what's happening, but I know what I like, what I'm seeing. Boom, it's actually a dream.
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious. Alice shows what happens is they do line up for the battle, and then Alice, who has the ability to see the future and I guess show people the future, she's the one that Michael Sheen wants to join their team, to join the Volturi. That's his ulterior motive. So she comes, she's been in hiding kind of, and then she steps onto the battlefield and she goes up to Aro, and that's how the battle begins. It's like, oh, she shows him something, and we don't see what he sees, and he has this moment of realization, but it goes sideways, and the big battle begins. But the battle that we see ends with Aro dying. Like, Bella and Edward murder him, and it's great. Like, that's the other thing. The battle doesn't end, like, sad in the sense that, like, oh, our heroes die. Like, it doesn't end that way. So the people you liked are still alive. Like, there are some that were dead, but
Are there. Like, some of the main characters are gone, though.
No, so that's
like
what I'm
crying.
Saying, though. Like, no, some of the main characters are gone. I agree. But the main ones are still alive. So what happens is, but it turned out that she just, when she did, like, touch Aro, he saw the entire battle. He's like, oh, this doesn't really pan out for me. Let's go home, everyone!
let's go for pancakes.
And it was just like, let's go for pancakes. And I would love that to be a deleted scene, like the Volturi just filling up an IHOP, just like, or there are Denny's, and Aro's like, I'll get the Grand Slam. So they don't go out for pancakes, unfortunately. But the ending, I mean, really, that's the moment. That's the moment where it's like, hey, let me show you a movie that takes chances. Let me show you a film that could maybe appeal to more than just the fan base. And let me show you why we're never going
to... So they technically stayed true... Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. But they technically stayed true to the book then. They just kind of inserted a scene where they were saying, here's what happens when you step outside of being beholden to the book and do something that's interesting. Like
precisely. And it kills all replay value for basically the entire film then. Because... Right. It's not just a matter, like, I mean, obviously, every time you see a film, you know what's going to happen next time, but you don't, I mean, you still be invested in the plot. I mean, it sweeps you up again. What Breaking Dawn Part 2 has done is leading up, you'll watch this battle for the first time and think it's awesome, and then the next time you'll be bored to tears, because it's like, I mean, it's cool to watch, I guess, but it's like, this isn't happening.
Yeah.
And
there's no emotional weight to it, because, you know, it's just a vision. Yeah.
It's just a vision. And then it's like, okay, well, we're done, and happy ending, roll credits, and it's like, yep. So
what is the actual ending of it then? Okay,
the ending
so
is
cool,
like,
baby's
everyone's
fine.
Cool, and then they they gather in front of the nice Cullen house, and we see Alice have another vision, and what she sees is Edward and Bella and Jacob and then teenage Renesmee hanging out on a beach,
nice,
smiling.
So she's actually like two in real time, probably.
Yeah, at that point she's probably two.
Probably.
That's not creepy at all.
But no. But what happens with the immortal child, I think is what you're asking, is the problem Arrow has is he says, okay, she's not an immortal, but we don't know what this is and we're scared of the unknown. So
right, but then they trot out this like Indian, this Native American guy who just came out of nowhere.
Yeah. What?
Yeah, like Ash, I'm sorry, I keep calling her Ashley Green, Alice and her dude, they're like, we found these people. And
he always looks like he's pooping.
Pretty much. So they're like, we found this guy, and he's just like Renesmee, and he explains that he's like, I'm a pretty normal dude, and I've been around for a while, and I can drink blood, and I can eat human food, and you know, I'm good either way, but I'm not hostile. It's all good. This is what she's going to be. You've seen a test case.
So
can we all go home?
Never mentioned or
never mentioned before. Never seen again. They literally brought him out of the woods.
That's where Alice and her dude went.
Yeah, they spent the whole movie like tracking down that guy and avoiding the Volturi.
That's how the book ends. That's how like they shake hands because they're like, oh, okay, Native American dude's cool. So you know.
Yeah, but Native American. It's like clearly
got along well with them, so that's fine.
Yeah. But what happens?
It's
in
like
the movie,
if this doesn't work out, I have lots of blankets.
Well, what happens in the movie, which I think is insane, is that the two like Transylvania vampires, after everyone says, "Okay, we're good," they say like, "Are you kidding? Like the Volturi are crazy. Like they're gonna come back." And it cuts to the. And I think Bill Condon did this on purpose. It cuts to the shot of the Cullens just like laughing and looking and like shaking their heads and just walking away. Just like, it's fine. Just smiling. Like, it's cool. Whatever. Which is insane because no,
they
like,
proved
this
themselves
been
unreliable. They're evil. They are bad guys. They wear black cloaks. Isn't that enough? Isn't that enough to say that they're bad people? Anyone?
So did they set up like anything that leads you to believe there's going to be a continuation or anything like that?
Well, I mean, when you think about it, do any of the other films, other than Bella and Edward having to get married, is there really anything? Like, is there anything in Eclipse that's like, there's more story left? I mean, it's something you can just build off of where Stephanie Meyer could just say, like, here's a new plot, and you'll go with it. I mean, yeah, she can do that, but as far as this movie goes, not really.
Okay.
It doesn't really like have a cliffhanger to it. At least I don't think so. Adam, do you think
No, it's all tied up in a very, very big neat bow.
Yeah, and it has the end credits are very much like, let's look back. And they include people in the credits who weren't even in this movie, but they were
just in the franchise.
They were in the franchise. So it really is sort of like, this is the end. It's sort of like how Return of the King ends, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, because those movies are, and that is the only time you'll hear me compare the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2 to The Return of the King. And so
until it wins an Oscar.
Until it wins all the Oscars, or the equivalent MTV Movie Awards.
I was just going to say, yeah, the Moon.
the reigning MTV Movie Awards champion, the Twilight Saga.
But this does, it perfectly encapsulates what's wrong with this franchise in that Bill Condon takes a chance to do something different. And I was like, my reaction was exactly like Matt's. Like, this is exciting. This is crazy. And the fans, even the fans of the book, like, they were really sad, but they were into it. And then as per like fidelity to the source material, it just like bullshit move of just like, never mind. So you see like this flash of like what could have, how this material could have been changed or adapted differently. But I think we now live in an age with, I think Stephanie Meyer has set precedence, and we're seeing this with The Hunger Games with Suzanne Collins being incredibly involved, that I think authors are essentially going to be like authoring their own franchises. I think J.K. Rowling did it the best with the Harry Potter franchise in that she said, you know, you're free to change what you want. She sat down for a table read of the script every time and said, you know, I'm planning something later. You might want to change
this. She consulted, but she wasn't actively involved in the film. You know?
Yeah, they were free to make it their own.
Furthermore, they kept Steve Close for all but one of them films.
Yeah.
And even the one he didn't do, Order of the Phoenix, I think is really good.
So, I agree. I think that was David Yates. And and David Heyman, producer.
Exactly. And who was... Well, they directed and produced. I think it was Michael Goldenberg who wrote the screenplay for Order of the Phoenix. But
Order of the Phoenix.
Anyway, so those films, though, it's funny. With Harry Potter, the two weakest entries, you know, Sorcerer's Stone and Chamber of Secrets, are the ones most loyal to the books.
Exactly.
So what does that tell you? It tells you that you got to give directors some freedom. You got to abbreviate. Now, and here's the thing. The Harry Potter films don't change any essential plots. Sirius
they eliminate a lot of side plots, yeah.
Yeah, they just eliminated side plots. And I don't know, maybe the Twilight books aren't heavy on side plots. I don't know what they're heavy on. Again, these movies spin their wheels a lot. So
I think they include everything.
They include everything.
There's an entire movie about getting ready to get married and then getting married. That's a movie.
Oh, I love it.
And
that's fantastic.
It really is. So, Twilight.
I think the Condon thing here, just to mention the fact that this is the last film in a series, so it's kind of like all cards are on the table now, so it's almost like you can kind of do what you want. Or at least that's, to me, that's how it felt with the books. Like when I was anticipating Deathly Hallows to come out for Rowling series, it was almost like she could have just written absolute crap and she would still sell. She would just make complete bank on that book. So it's kind of the same thing with the movies. Like, you can take a few more chances because it's the last one. You don't have to, you know, appease that fan base to make sure they come back for the next time because it's the last hurrah. So I'm actually kind of surprised they didn't get a little more, I don't know, have a little more freedom with it. But I guess that dream sequence is as far as they were willing to go.
Exactly. So I guess that's the end of Twilight, but the beginning of new franchises. Although, are you guys... I mean, we've seen a trailer for Mortal Instruments. We've seen a trailer for Beautiful Creatures. You guys looking forward to those?
The one, I think it was the Beautiful Creatures one, actually looked... It looked more interesting to me than Twilight did. I'll say that. Yeah.
It looks interesting, and the actors in that movie are crazy good. I think it'll be campy, but I think it's like owning its camp, like owning its weirdness. See, it looks kind of interesting.
It does. I will get, Beautiful Creatures, and I definitely think Emmy Rossum's character in particular seems pretty interesting. So that one, I think, potential. Mortal Instruments is just so far off. And it, to be fair, Mortal Instruments, the books came out before Twilight, but also, let's be fair, the Twilight movies have set the rules of movies in this genre. So we'll see.
Mortal Instruments has a big fan following, though. I wouldn't be surprised if those movies get big.
Yeah, so we'll see how all of them go. And so long, Twilight.
Till next time.
Till next time. Till the reboot. Till the inevitable Stephanie Meyer's like, maybe I do want more money. That was so weak of her to be like, you guys know that she was working on another book.
Yeah.
And then a draft leaked out, and she's like, no, I don't want to do this anymore. And I'm like, really? That killed your creative impulse to be like, my book got out? And I'm like,
I mean, I can understand it from the writer's perspective of if you have something that you're working on, and, you know, there's obviously a lot of pressure with her, you know, whatever.
I agree, but...
And then the fact that it gets out there and it's like half finished, it's like, that's, I don't know.
I agree, but does that really... Can the story really be that good if that was enough to kill? I mean,
it was
really,
it's Twilight from Edward's perspective.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
What can be that different?
It's like the entire book is like, I look at this ground a lot. I shamble, and, you know, I feel particularly sparkly today. That's my life. All right. So I'll raise my fast aging child. So we'll do that.
Isn't she dead now? I mean, the movie's been out for 2 days. She should be dead by now, right?
No, and again, the Native American explains that he stopped aging when he was,
25.
25. Like, he stopped aging when he was 25.
How convenient.
Yeah, it's weird. But he got his driver's license when he was 10, technically. So it all worked out. All right, so let's move on to our recommendations. Dave, what do you got for us?
I'm going to go with something that's completely different from the Twilight series, with the exception of vampirism, and I'm going to go back to 1985's Once Bitten. If you're looking for a good movie, this isn't it, but it's a lot of fun, and it's actually it's the first, I believe it's the first lead role for Jim Carrey. So back in 1985, before In Living Color, before Ace Ventura, any of the things that people kind of know him for now, first lead role in Once Bitten. He plays a virgin in Los Angeles, which is apparently really difficult to find in the 1980s, as this Countess Vampire finds out, played by Lauren Hutton. Once a year, leading up to Halloween, she has to bite a virgin and drink virgin blood three separate times so that she can maintain her youth and immortality for at least another year. And like I said, it's difficult to find virgins in Los Angeles in the 80s. So she tries to round up a bunch of people. She comes across Mark, I believe his name is. And Mark Kendall is played by Jim Carrey, who has a girlfriend at the time. She just keeps putting him off and putting him off, putting him off. So basically, him and his buddies go out on the town one night. He gets seduced by this countess. She takes him back home. They don't have sex, but she bites him, and then he passes out. So she's got her first of three hits of virgin blood. And then he starts to kind of have this transformation throughout the story. He's starting to get a little paler. He's avoiding sunlight. He's drinking blood from, like, raw steaks. And his friends are starting to see some sort of transformation. The best part of the film, and I'm going to ruin the ending because it's once bitten and who really cares. But
I care!
I won't ruin it explicitly, but I will say that compared to the Twilight movies, Once Bitten features a scene where sex actually saves people from vampires, instead of kind of pushing it off for the longest time and making it weird to have, like, sexual interests, kind of going back to the misogynistic themes that we were talking about earlier on. So if you want to go check out an early movie featuring Jim Carrey that's incredibly campy, actually features Cleavon Little too, which people would know as the sheriff from Blazing Saddles, and a younger Megan Mullally, which I was surprised to find. If you can pick her out in the movie, you probably know Megan Mullally too well, because I have no idea where she turns up in this movie. But 1985, Once Bitten.
All right. Adam, what about you?
I'm recommend a Bill Condon film that's Twilight. It's Kinsey, his 2004 biography of scientist Alfred Kinsey. And it really – and I know Matt's recommendation is a Condon film, and I really think that you should seek these out just to kind of see what he does with something that's not Twilight. But this movie is a really, really good biography. If you don't know who Kinsey was, 1948 he published Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, which was the first of the so-called Kinsey reports. And he really kind of got sex out of, you know, that controversial thing that people don't talk about and put it into a scientific perspective. And he just interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, just documenting all kinds of different sexual behavior and sexual habits, and also did a lot for homosexuality, showing people that weren't alone in feeling that they were homosexual or anything like that. It stars Liam Neeson in the lead role, who's very, very good here, and I really wish he would do kind of branch out a bit more than the Taken stuff nowadays, but I understand he needs money. It also stars Laura Linney, who is I believe they got married. She's kind of his partner, but there's a lot of kind of sexual wing and sexual kind of inhibition in here. But it also portrays him as a man who, you know, he's showing all this openness towards sex and everything like that. But it shows kind of the toll it takes on him and his relationship with his wife. Peter Sarsgaard is also great here. Chris O'Donnell's in the movie. John Lithgow, Oliver Platt. It's really, really fascinating, interesting biography, great work by Condon. So seek it out.
All right. I will finish up with Bill Condon's 1998 film, Gods and Monsters, which I think, well, the film, brief synopsis, it follows James Whale, who directed Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein, but it opens in the 1950s. Wherein, obviously, those films had been out for years and years and years, so he's in the twilight of his life, and he is a homosexual. Yeah, sorry. Twilight. I tied it all back, bitches. I knew what I was doing. And he is in his closing days. He is will no longer break dawn in the eclipse of his... No, you fuckers brought it up. My entire recommendation is just completely derailed. All right, back on track. This is a really great film. So Ian McKellen plays James Whale, the director of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein. And so he's old, and he's been a little bit forgotten, in a sense, but he hires a gardener, played by Brendan Fraser, who is also incredible in the film. And so they begin this sort of strange friendship where they're being open with each other, and Whale is slowly dying. He's becoming weaker. He's having mini strokes. And so they have this weird relationship developing where Fraser's character isn't gay. And so this place, again, going back to Kinsey, I mean, this takes place in a time when homosexuality is not openly discussed, and it's met with disgust. So it's a very strange film, but also very sort of sad and moving, and I think it's Condon's best. I mean, I like Kinsey a lot. I think he did a great job writing the screenplay for Chicago. And
you think it's better than Candyman Farewell to the Flesh?
Never mind. Candyman Farewell to the Flesh.
I just want to make sure, that's all.
That is true. So I would recommend Gods and Monsters. Okay.
It's a great movie.
So we are still deciding on our next podcast. There are Thanksgiving movies to discuss. But going back to Star Wars, I think we will be doing something Star Wars related, something very cool. And there is, this will tie into a series of. I will force choke you out, Dave. I will force choke you the fuck out.
Sorry, guys, I won't be here next week.
So there's a very cool series of articles coming to the site, and we would like to talk with their author about Star Wars. So I think that's the direction we're going. Cool. It's looking that way, depending on availability, and I kind of want to talk about that. So I would say if you like Star Wars, and really, who doesn't? I don't anymore. I will, by the end of this whole sequel trilogy thing, I will think Star Wars is the worst thing that has ever happened to humanity. simply because I am a lazy human being. I mean, really, that's what it boils... Isn't that what it boils down to? It's like, I don't want to work and report Star Wars news. I'll go work in a coal mine. You know, it's one of those
things. We're just going to write you a template article that you can just swap names of actors or directors
and just
out.
Plug in.
Pretty much. Yep. All right.
Blank has tweeted that blank things.
Yes, speaking of Twitter, if you want to follow this podcast on Twitter, you can follow any of us on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter. I have to find a better fucking way to say this. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you?
At Adam Chitwood.
And Dave?
At Team Goldberg. At Dr. Claw MD.
All right, thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.